Welcome to the Your Wetlands Podcast. This conversation took place at lunch with three colleagues of the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture. Mark Holmes, Program Director of the Bay Institute, Arthur Feinstein, a member of the Citizens Committee to Complete the Refuge and the Legislative Chair of the Joint Venture, and Diane Ross-Leach, Director of Environmental Policy for Pacific Gas and Electric Company. She's also the Vice Chair of the Joint Venture. We brought together these Joint Venture Management Board members to learn about some of their current concerns and inspirations regarding wetland restoration around the San Francisco Bay Area. Arthur Feinstein begins our discussion by talking about a proposed bridge project in a San Francisco park.
Well, I started earlier when we first got together talking about this threat to Candlestick Point State Recreation Area, which is one of our state parks. And state parks always seem to be threatened for some reason or other. People see them as places where you can put roads or other kinds of structures as if it was just empty public lands rather than a precious resource. And so there is plan for Candlestick Point State Recreation Area, a bridge right across a very sensitive wetland connected by two four-lane roads that actually divide the park into three different pieces. And if you're a small mammal or reptile, you're undoubtedly going to be roadkill at some point in this park because of all the car traffic.
What's the reason that this is being proposed?
So they can save 4 minutes of travel time going from point A to point B. And at $40 million extra cost, it's $10 million a minute to be able to save 4 minutes.
And this is just an interesting example of a story. I didn't know anything about this particular story, but the things we hear about, the trade-offs, the things we need to evaluate. So here, and whether it's a great idea or not, the point is there's a cost, there's an impact, and in this case, to save 4 minutes. Maybe it's something we want to move forward on, but at least people should have that kind of information to really evaluate what's going on and what the impact is. Diane, what about you? Is there something that you're working on?
Well, building on what Arthur was talking about, I guess it is important to preserve these public spaces. And there's always been encroachments or development proposed adjacent to a lot of the public open spaces. I'm aware of this Kohl's department store proposal that's over by the Hoffman Marsh and near Richmond, kind of bordering Albany, Richmond. And again, that's another one where maybe people are not aware of the possible impacts of something like that were to go in, and so close to a sensitive marsh public recreation area that it can attract a lot of nuisance animals, cats and whatnot that would affect the sensitive habitat and the marsh species.
Mark Holmes, what about you?
Well, the thing that has preoccupied me ever since I've been in this business, the thing I think people are least aware of, even residents of the area, is how much different the bay is today from what it was originally, 150 years ago. Basically, we had a bay that was about 35% larger 150 years ago than it is today. There were 200,000 acres of tidal marshes that were here, of which only 35,000 acres remain. There's been a loss of 160,000 acres of tidal marsh in the bay. And many people, as they drive around the bay, they go over these flatlands. And even if we're just talking about the Nimitz Freeway or the East Shore Freeway or Highway 37, they don't realize that they're driving on former tidal marsh. That's why those roads were put there. They were filled. The second thing, which is kind of the positive side of the story, is that many of those 160,000 acres of tidal marshes that were drained can be reconnected to the bay again if we decide to do it. And there's a process underway to do that. Several thousand acres have been restored already, and we can restore more than 100,000 acres if we find the collective will to do it. It would be a phenomenal transformation of the bay ecologically. It would restore much of the vitality that was lost, and I think most people around the area are not aware of this story.
It's interesting that one of the themes of this just brief conversation is trade-offs and perspective. And it seems to me that one of the things that keeps ringing home to me is restoring the earth really is one of the great stories, one of the great opportunities that we can seize to make a difference on the planet, and even to make a difference in our lives. With respect to that story, restoring the earth, what's an example, Arthur, of a place that you've seen restored, maybe not completed the restoration process, but that you've seen restored that just inspired you? Is there an example?
Well, actually, there's quite a few, but one that both Mark and I worked on is the Martin Luther King Wetland Restoration Project in the Martin Luther King Regional Shoreline Park in San Leandro Bay in Oakland. The wetland there is called Arrowhead Marsh in San Leandro Bay. And back in the 1920s and 30s, we had something like 18,000 acres of wetland tidal marsh in San Leandro Bay. That's now the Coliseum. In 1980s, there were only 46 acres of tidal marsh left. And the Oakland Airport decided it was going to fill in part of those to create some development and save the bay and Golden Gate Audubon. Over 10 years and three or four lawsuits convinced the port to not do so and actually to deed the land they wanted to develop to the East Bay Regional Park District and restore approximately 70 acres to tidal marsh. That tidal marsh restoration project actually worked. And you go out there now and it's lovely. It's filled with birds. It's beginning to vegetate back the way we hoped for. It was designed to build habitat for an endangered bird, the California clapper rail, and they have at least seen one or two in there at some point. And it's just lovely. It's a great place for people to go and walk around.
Diane, I want to ask you a question from a little different perspective, and that is corporations, and you represent a corporation, you work for a corporation. Many corporations donate money for various causes. When you communicate a project to your colleagues that you think is a good idea, what's your challenge in communicating it to your colleagues and getting their positive response?
It's a good question. I think my job at PG&E is to show the connection to why PG&E as a business in the San Francisco Bay Area or as employees that live in the San Francisco Bay Area, why we should care and do something maybe that's beyond our business, like charitable contributions to different projects or different organizations that are doing things that may seem different than our business. But we try to show that connection that, you know, how habitat enhancements in the Bay Area will improve the quality of life, will make workers happy, employees happy, bring more businesses here, that's a good thing for our overall business climate as well. So that's how we try to connect, you know, the human element to some of these projects that may seem kind of foreign to people.
That's interesting. When you think about what President Obama is talking about in the healthcare area or in the economy, one of his challenges is to make the connections. That if we lower healthcare costs, what does that do to business? What does it obviously do to the fundamental care of Americans? So that's another theme here, is making the connections. Sometimes we do a better job of it. Sometimes they're not clear connections, or they're not the connections we would have expected. And Mark Holmes, what's on your mind regarding a project?
Well, when you first asked Arthur, and he would have been the same one that I had mentioned, and I was just out at Arrowhead Marsh last month. And so in preparation of going for the trip, I was actually going out there to try to film some clapper rails. And in preparation of going to the trip, I looked at some of the old maps, the pre-fill maps that showed the marshes before Oakland Airport was even there. And it was an enormously complex, large place. And I could imagine just looking at the map, how it was just filled with wildlife at the time, including clapper rails. There had to have been thousands of clapper rails out there when it was an 18,000-acre site. Now, as I went down to film the area, I had to plan first to find a high tide, because the only time that the clapper rails can be seen is when the tide is high. Otherwise, they're rooted down into the between the cordgrass and the marsh. They never come out. And it didn't occur to me as I was driving down from Sacramento with my camera to go out there that every other photographer would be there on this highest tide of the year. And I got to the boardwalk, and it was lined with probably 60 photographers, 27 tripods, long telephoto lens, all trained on these various areas where they were hoping to see a clapper rail as it was forced up out by high tide into an area where they could photograph it. And so we all sat there for 2 hours, starting from the peak of the tide until the tide went down. And these rails are so conditioned, they're so genetically trained to not move when the tide is high, because that's when they're most vulnerable to predators. If they're seen, if they're detected by a predator, a bird, a peregrine falcon historically, a coyote in the marsh or something like that. They're very vulnerable. So we had our eyes trained on about four different clapper rails, a Virginia rail, and two soras. There are several species of rails that live in the marsh, these birds that live nowhere but marshes at all. And so they had their cameras trained on them, waiting for them to move so they catch a glint of light off the eye. But the rails wouldn't move. They're just frozen in place. So they stood there, and pretty soon the photographers, the less patient ones, drifted away early, and pretty soon the boardwalk, which had contained, scores of photographers, was empty. It was empty. The tide was down. The clapper rails were nowhere to be seen, and I was pacing up and down the boardwalk, hoping that I could just by chance catch a rail before I left. So I finally decided to leave. I walked off the boardwalk onto the shore. I set my tripod and my video camera for one last shot, an overview of the marsh looking out across the bay. And damned if a rail didn't walk out on 15 feet from me. It had been so dehydrated by standing out there frozen for so long it had to get a drink of water. It walked right in front of me into the channel and started drinking. And I was getting this all on camera. And then it started bathing in the water down there. And I got about 5 minutes of this wonderful shot of this lonely clapper rail. There are only fewer than 1,000 left in the world. They're all in San Francisco Bay. And here it was. Everybody else had been waiting, and I had been waiting for 3 hours to get a glimpse of the rail. And he finally deigned to come out and show himself after everybody had left.
That is a great story, and we'll be talking with many people involved in restoration in the coming weeks to hear their stories as well. If you want to subscribe to our podcast so you can receive them automatically, please visit yourwetlands.org/podcast. Once again, I want to thank Mark Holmes, Program Director of the Bay Institute, Arthur Feinstein, a member of the Citizens Committee to Complete the Refuge, and Diane Ross Leach, Director of Environmental Policy for Pacific Gas and Electric Company. Your Wetlands is a project of the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture. To learn more, you can visit them online at sfbayjv.org. And we're supported by grants from the California Coastal Conservancy and PG&E. If you'd like to share a comment or a suggestion or an idea for a future podcast, we'd very much like to hear from you. Our email address, yourwetlands@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Jerry Kay.